You have to know that the more you depend on the degree guaranteeing your job, you're really putting it at the biggest risk of, you know how they say you can't beat the market. You can't fight the market. If the market in India is the sheer size of the population, just like you, there are thousands and thousands and millions of people studying for the same degree. If it's coming from that mindset, what are you really doing with the education system?
Correct.
Made enough time in my daily schedule to be reading for about 3 to 4 hours daily.
3 to 4 hours
daily.
Wow. Yeah.
If we don't go above and beyond that degree and use that, we are doing a disservice to our context. And what we have been blessed with.
Yeah.
Not to say, degree ne mere ko kharab kar diya, isme mere ko paise nahi mil rahe.
Correct.
Wo tumhari problem hai.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jivraj. And today I have with me a super exciting guest. Join me in welcoming Sarthak Ahuja, who is a founder, who is a creator, who is an author, who is a lifelong learner, and much more. Thank you so much, Sarthak, for joining me. Super delighted to be hosting you.
Thanks, Jivraj. Pleasure is all mine.
Yes, I'm so glad. I've had the distinct pleasure of having known you for a brief while before this recording, and also as an observer, like so many of us, really enjoying your content and all the amazing insights that you've put out on the internet. But I want to take this opportunity today to dive deeper into many parts of your persona, because when I was researching, the interesting part was, you know, how does a Delhi boy who gets into Shaheed Sukhdev, who becomes the youngest Indian to complete these amazing certifications and, you know, many courses, the CA, CMS and CS, then go into, you know, the family business, but decides to then go to ISB, pursue B school, but not sit for placements, and then, you know, start your own collective, then become a creator, become an author, right? This is the entire ambit for context. And this just seemed like, you know, as I was telling you, this constant thread of just picking things up, excelling at them, and picking up contrary things to what may be the flavor of the season, yet really pursuing them so well, is the constant thread I've observed, and I think I want to dive deeper into it. But what might be a good way to start is, I think, considering there are a host of things that you do, I want to ask you this, what adequately represents what you do? And why you do it. If we can, I think, start very briefly with that, it gives us enough context to dive deeper into some of those bits.
Okay. I think the question you're asking me is also something that Stanford Graduate School of Business
yes.
would ask people,
inspired
what motivates
from the
you?
Essay.
Yeah?
Yes.
And why? And I think the more I think about it, I feel thankfully, and it comes with a great deal of blessings and privilege, I'm not as driven by money or wealth creation. And I think for me, wherever I feel I'm learning something or I'm improving, that just automatically becomes a motivator. So I've never thought thinking I need to do this because this place has a lot of money. Very contrary to what I do, because I'm a consultant for business owners on
right.
where to build, how to make money. But myself, I'm not really bothered about I need to make these many crores or these many millions of dollars, and so I'm just very happy when I find something exciting and it's yeah. food for thought.
And that comes from a place of some amount of privilege?
100%. I think it comes from privilege also is a very wide range and spectrum, right? So I think privileged enough to know that you can imagine two professionals, both my parents are CAs in practice, you know. Simple, small, modest practices in Delhi growing up. So they've always made enough to ensure we went to good schools, had everything that we wanted, possibly took a couple of foreign vacations back in school growing up. And I think that was enough and more privilege, much more than I could have ever expected. So
yeah.
100%.
That's lovely. No, I'm glad you've been able to, you know, articulately put it, because sometimes when you think of, you know, not talking about wealth, it gets taken in a site where there is some amount of privilege, but recognizing it and also knowing that I think wealth is one part of it, but not the only driver, is what you're trying to say, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, I think wealth gives you a cushion. I feel, you know, I was having this conversation with someone the other day where I said, what is the ideal amount that someone should earn? In India, living in a tier one Indian city today, okay, imagine someone who's living on a salary.
Yeah.
If they really want to keep growing and making more money, ideally, any earning above a package of 60 lakh per annum then ends up becoming a number. or a race to say concepts like FIRE, you know, financial independence, retire early and stuff like that. Ideally, if your insurances are in place, you know, there's some amount of family backing, some inheritance in terms of a house or a place to live in. I think 5 lakhs per month of disposable income is actually enough for people to ensure that they take foreign holidays, they eat good food, they entertain themselves, they take care of their families, and they do all of that. Beyond that is just a number. So I think when you have that kind of clarity in your mind, that beyond this point, do I really want to optimize for money or do I want to optimize for other aspects of my life? And I think for me, other very important aspects are being able to give quality time to my wife, being able to learn, because that really inspires me if there's something new. Also being able to take care of one's health.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't want to compromise on those bits only in an attempt to make maybe a couple of more crores a year or so. It just doesn't matter.
Got it. I think that's lovely. I'm glad you put a number to it because otherwise it, you know, seems very abstract in nature. But that's right. I think beyond a point, it's just a pursuit and desire to keep earning more without knowing why. And I think that really summarizes it well. So recognizing that, you know, money is a number beyond a point is a great, I think it just brings liberty into the frame, right? Like you can pursue other things. But going back to now, you know, the series of events, right? The way I thought we'll do this is deconstruct many parts of what you're doing and go deeper into how you've been able to excel at them and then understand the reasoning behind it, right? One of those, and I want to go in reverse. So let's start with the most recent bit, right? A lot of people now, of course, know you for the creator persona that you've been able to build for yourself by, you know, showcasing incredible business insights on the internet. Something that a lot of us want to understand, a lot of us want to learn about, but don't have the right avenues for. The way you've done that is also through books, right? Which are written in very great sort of brief English for the common man, for the mass, to help them understand what fundraising is about, what startups are about, what founders can do well, right? Your two books, Daily Coffee and Startups and Founders Office, are just like incredible. What I want to understand from you is when you started, you know, putting out your internet persona out in a world where, you know, content is a dopamine hit, right? So you're feeding into everybody else's dopamine, right? How did you sort of make that choice? And what was your sort of North Star and how has that evolved over time?
Yeah, so, you know, back in school, I was made the editor of the school magazine. I was one of the editors and one of my tasks through the year was motivating and pushing other people to submit articles for the magazine, which could go at the end of the year. Yeah. I kept doing it very diligently all through, and towards the end, the teacher coordinator said, hey, you're one of the editors, where's your editorial piece, which we're going to publish? And I was like, oh God, how am I going to sit down and write one full page for the article? And I was really scared. And another of my friends who really used to enjoy writing had written a bunch of pieces, so I liked one of his pieces. I borrowed it from him and submitted it in my name. So it's still there in the school magazine in my name, but I had not written it. And the guilt for doing that kind of stuck with me for so long that, you know, when I was in undergrad back in college, I could just not forget I'd done something like that for about 3-4 years.
Yeah.
And that came from the fact that I was constantly afraid of people judging what I would put out in public display. So I said, it's about time that I face that fear, improve on myself as a writer. So even if it's worth all the judgment in the world, let's just get on the path of improving. So I think that was the North Star metric that I wanted to face my fears.
Right.
That was one major fear. I started this blog called My Life as a Jalebi back in 2011. Yeah. It was almost like Malgudi days for, you know, people in the 90s from Delhi. So, you know, typical Punjabi family growing up in Delhi. I would write about the food of Delhi and, you know, the culture of growing up with your grandparents. What is it like when relatives come over? So it was a humor blog. And I kept writing and writing till about 2017. 2015, it got the Best Humor Blog of India Award by Blogadda. And I think that was never the North Star metric. The North Star metric was I don't want to be scared of writing anymore.
Yeah.
That's what it was back then. In terms of video content then, I think it started more as a way to productize my knowledge.
Yeah,
because the same founders keep asking you the same questions every day. You know, how do you set up an ESOP? How do you think about equity split? How do you think about valuations? And I thought, rather than answering it again and again, might as well make a video. Yeah. Because if I send them a link to the video, they feel the comfort that it's his answer. It's not a random link from the internet.
Right.
You know, so that's how those videos started. Then they became training content for my team. Mm-hmm. Because they were also learning from me every day and not having to wait an entire month for one Saturday being blocked out for training and development and whatnot, which I felt was becoming more of a sham because making them sit all through the day taking notes, you know, half of them are dozing off.
Yeah.
So I felt this was probably an optimum way to do it. Then gradually it also started becoming a marketing channel because as distribution grew, it was a way for us to talk about the kind of things we do very indirectly. Yeah. And letting people know that, okay, they're somewhere into consulting, investment banking, yeah, where they're talking about these things. That happened. But I think more than that, is 100 days down into making content, I had practically nothing else left to talk about.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's ridiculous. I've been in this profession for 10 years.
Yeah.
And in 100 insights, all my insights are over. So I am just so replaceable.
Yeah.
And there is no moat in my knowledge. So I think, like all professionals, you know, you're working 12 to 15 hours a day and you feel you have no time. For me, I realized, okay, today I need to come up with a topic. I will have to study for an hour or two to take out an insight, right? So I remember I would get done with work at about 10 in the night,
yeah,
get back home, have my food, spend some time with my wife. The moment she would doze off at about 12:30, I would open up my iPad, start reading some report, some books, probably take 1 or 2 hours, note down an insight, and the following morning, the moment I would get up, take a bath, without having my breakfast, I would just rush, record a video and be done for the day. So I think that was the process, and the fact that I've told myself that I won't allow myself a day off, not more than one day in like 15 days.
Mm-hmm.
So which means at least 28 pieces of content has been going out
every month for the last
for the last almost 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And I think that for me is a learning and development gym for myself. So followers, no followers, how many people watch it? Of course, the idea is to disseminate information that most people benefit from it. But I think the North Star metric has not been the follower count or the money one makes from monetizing content because
you don't.
Yeah, so we don't monetize content, and so far, not saying there's anything wrong with it, so far we haven't, and our metric has just been L&D.
Yeah.
So I think it's also, you know, there's a little bit of, I would say, selfishness also there, because when you tell people about give your customers what the customer wants, I am putting myself in the shoes of the customer also. What is it that I want to learn today?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm learning what I want to learn, hoping that there are other people in the market who would also want to know this.
Right.
So I think in a Venn diagram, that's kind of like the overlap.
Yeah, that's lovely. I think, you know, parts of that I am familiar with, but to understand that entire internal drive to do this, and the best part, and this is what I want to double click on, is that you've not complicated the process, right? Like you've stayed true to the exact ideology that you started with. You don't do any fancy production. You don't do any, you know, not to say again, with all due respect, you don't do any fancy content gimmicks, right? You've stayed true to unique ideas, insights, business learnings, and you've put them out in a recording all throughout, right? Talk to us about how important that is, and would you continue doing it had the results not shown up? You spoke about this briefly, but how do you keep a frugal mindset, not hire maybe somebody else to do your scripting, right? Take up a fancy setup. How do you stay away from those, you know, motivations to keep growing and make this your primary thing? Because it is a sizable thing right now. How do you resist that and stay true to what you started off with?
I think because, like I said, for me, it wasn't optimizing for money. It's optimizing for fulfillment, right? And what people see is like a 1 minute insight, you know, and I remember people in my family, a few friends initially would say, why are you giving away this information for free? Because a lot of the insights, I remember how many days and months I worked on certain projects, or reports to dig
Post
out.
Which, yeah.
And then when I would just put it out, some of them would say, we know how hard you've been working on diving deeply into this industry and pulling this out. So don't give it away. And I felt, no. So if someone thinks that just watching a 1 minute video, you know, they can get the entire background of what has led to that insight.
Yeah,
that's in some way undermining the effort I have put in.
Yeah.
And that's also in some way giving people the unrealistic view ke bas ye content dekh lo and you will learn everything.
Right.
So I always say, you know, there's only so much you can express in 60 seconds.
Yeah.
A lot of those topics are worth diving deeply into. So if I were to outsource the scripting or the research process, you know, there's only, I mean, my learning will stop. So the idea with not doing edits, with not doing any of that is it has to be a sustainable daily process. Because if it's not happening daily, it doesn't become part of your personality. It doesn't become a daily habit. It doesn't become a lifelong thing that you can continue to do. So I do have an EA. And what I do is in terms of process, I've got a WhatsApp group with just myself, which is called Content Ideas, pinned right at the top. Anytime we're in a conversation, either with an investor, a founder, any business consulting meeting, some founder that I'm coaching, some insight that comes out, I'll just make a note. As long as it's not confidential, I'll note it down. I'll probably at some point send it to my EA saying, can you just do a quick Google search of the first three pages on Google to see what you get? What they do is they do a filtering mechanism for me. So my EA will just pull out those links, read through it, and he'll give me links to read. Then I deep dive, then I have a few more questions. Okay, let's dive deeper into this. The good thing is, over the past 2-3 years, I've made enough time in my daily schedule to be reading for about 3 to 4 hours daily.
Wow.
So when I'm reading 3 to 4 hours daily...
3 to 4 hours
daily?
Wow. Yeah,
pretty much. I think worst days would be about an hour and a half, two. But thankfully, it's become part of my daily routine. So about an hour, hour and a half would be newsletters that I'm subscribed to. So I think daily I get about anywhere between 50 to 70 newsletters. Half of them I would probably delete from the subject line because it's something I know or I don't want to read about. The other half, a few I'll skim through, a few I'll dive deeply into, which will give me a few ideas. Then I'll go down the rabbit hole just researching, calling up founders who are in that space.
Yeah.
If I know someone from CBS or ISB who's in it, you know, just call him up, be like, I'm really... And I can be very annoying in the sense I'm not going to check with people if they're available or not. I'm going to just start randomly calling people and being like, I need this answer.
That's such a skill, no? Like, just asking for help is a skill.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not ashamed and I feel... I am never ashamed telling people that I don't know something. And I think that also comes from a place of God being kind and some blessings and privilege where you can only ask when you're certain that they're not going to judge you about not knowing something. And, you know,
right.
For that, you have to show value in terms of you know a bunch of other things, so it's okay to not know this,
correct,
right?
Correct.
But I just, every day, I'm in the hunt for some insight. And it's fun. I think... If I were to monetize it, if I were to do a full jing-bang setup around it, then it'll become a business, right? And for me, even if content is something which gives you much more ROI in terms of the time that you put in, but the day I were to shut down the consulting and the iBanking practice, all the insights that I have will only be bookish insights because I will be so distant from practical reality, you know, experiencing how things are being built, that my content insights as a moat will completely disappear and I'll be like every other content creator who's just researching and speaking it out loud rather than being in the midst of things.
That's true. And that's what differentiates you as well, I think. It comes from a point of some amount of great credibility, which really speaks for itself. So kudos to what you're doing. I have one final question to, you know, bring this piece to a close, which is to say the, you know, most asked question, and I put this very small poll up, and a bunch of people keep asking, how does Sarthak research, right? Because it just seems like you're putting things out on the internet which are not already out there, yet feel relatable in nature. What is the process to distill these insights and actually select which ones to put out versus not? What is your consumer lens to it? Would love to know that piece.
Correct. So I think in a lot of the individual consulting calls that I've done over the past few months, and I don't do too many, so I wish I had the time to, but maybe once every month, I try and block out about 2 days where I would just agree to some individual calls, and I'll probably wrap up about 15-20 in those 2 days. And I think those calls really give me a lot of insights on what is it that consumers want to know. It so happened over the past few months that a lot of very credible people have asked me questions like, which business should we get into? I have access to this much capital, or I want to build in this geography, or I'm skilled in this space, but I just don't know what idea to pursue. And I think earlier I would feel that's a very bad question to be asking someone, because my job probably comes in when you're starting a business. But I realized then that's actually not true. This is what the consumer wants. So many people in India, even family businesses who maybe started 30 years ago, right? They've gone through the phase of making enough money and reached a point where their industry is now commoditized to such an extent that there are no supernormal profits. And with all the surplus either going into setting up a new factory or buying another real estate property, they actually want to put it into more active use in building a newer line of business. Yeah. That's where they need guidance. So the process has been, now whenever I go anywhere or I imagine in this room we see this carpet, right? So the other day I was just looking at the carpet in my drawing room, and I was like, okay, I don't know how many people in India really buy carpets.
Yeah.
Is carpets a thing? How big is the market? And I just parked it somewhere, you know, in my content ideas, that someday when I find the time, I'm going to research about it. The other day I was, on the Government of India website on looking at some export data. I was just out of my curiosity, what is it that India exports? So I pulled out this PDF which said it ranked the highest exports from India in the month of August 2023. And I saw carpets there. Now, like, carpets was a thing I wanted to do, and I see over 2,000 crores of carpets are exported in 1 month. I mean, that's practically $2 billion or more worth of carpets exports in a year. So there has to be something. That's when I was like, okay, I can't push it for anymore. I started researching carpets. I opened up Traction. I started looking at what kind of carpet companies are listed here. There were a few. I started looking at their unit economics. I looked up the Carpet Export Promotion Council's website. They have so many reports. They do so many exhibitions and expos. So I think I must have researched it for about 3 hours. And then I thought, okay, let me just, whatever I've learned, let me just summarize it in less than, say, 3,000 characters. I have another WhatsApp group to myself where I just type out the insight. And then I just copy it from my phone, post it on LinkedIn. And then whenever I'm sitting, probably having a cup of coffee or after dinner, whenever I find the time, I'll just put up the phone, put up the camera, and just speak it out loud and push it out.
Wow, love it. I think generally being very insight driven is my takeaway from that, and that's a great way to live life in general as well, right? Not just to create content, but to build businesses and to be a curious person. I love that. Thank you for sharing. Maybe let's take a different turn to the conversation, and let's get to your, let's say, ISB life, right? So you are this, you've done undergrad, you've done these multiple courses, the CS, EMS, CS. You've done your family business for a while, but then you decide to pursue MBA. This is 2015, 2016. You get into ISB, one of the most prestigious institutions for B schools in the country. You have a great time, but you decide to opt out of placements and you do your thing, and that's what you've been doing since. In the context of the broader scheme of things, it's been 7 years since you've done the MBA. How do you think things have evolved? Do you think MBA holds the same amount of value that it used to? And what was the role it played in your life? I think that'll be a good sort of entire viewpoint to understand from your lens.
Yeah, I think I was very sure on why I wanted an MBA. And this was probably, even when I was in the 10th grade, I was I was actually trained by my parents to so driven and spoken about how great the CA profession is, and rightfully so.
Yeah.
That I knew I had to become a CA. You know, it was just all the doggy training over right. all the years that led to it. And I would tell my parents, okay, I'm gonna pursue CA, but that will not stop me from pursuing an MBA.
Right.
And back then I felt MBA, because I did not want to just study accounting and taxation and stuff, I thought MBA would expose me to a lot more subjects to be able to figure out what I really want to do. So I did the CA Jing Bang, and after some time of doing taxation and audits, it just wasn't exciting me enough. But I realized that I wanted to do something of my own. Call it the business background, professional family, looking at a lot of tax returns and knowing how businessmen tend to earn much more or have much more flexibility in terms of doing experiments and trying different things, right?
Yeah.
Rather than telling yourself, I am an accountant or I am a marketing guy and I'll only keep doing this yeah. for the rest of my life. So when I was going for an MBA, I knew it had to be for two things primarily. One, a brand, and two, the network. Brand, because I felt CA as a degree, and a lot of other professional degrees, and it's not just for CA, I mean engineering, if you think about it, or architects, or even doctors, you know, for that matter, someone who's an MBBS. Every professional will now feel that there are so many professionals in the market that it's now become a commodity. So you need something that differentiates you, right? So I felt that if I had to pivot towards consulting, an MBA would give me added credibility. So that brand is what I wanted, but I also wanted to work in India. So I knew if I were to take up an MBA outside of India, you know, it just so happens that then people find opportunities outside, then, you know, end up settling abroad.
Yeah.
I wanted to be here. ISB turned out to be a great opportunity, because I felt CAT ke jitna padhne ka to himmat nahi hai. Like, I was like, no matter
how I failed to believe that, because you've been excelling in academics all throughout.
So finally, one of my very close friends, he was at a top IIM, and we studied in undergrad together, after which he had worked at McKinsey for about 3 years, and then he went to the IIM, and he kept telling me that, you know, it's been slightly disappointing as an experience to see that 70 to 75% of my class is fresh out of engineering college.
Yeah.
So the kind of perspectives I bring to the class, I feel my class is failing me in terms of peer learning. So, you know, there were a lot of these conversations where he said, I feel now that ISB might be better from a peer learning perspective.
Right.
So, you know, him saying that, then the market also telling me that ISB probably tries to give you a more international MBA experience. Yeah. Then saying international bhi karna hai, but India mein karna hai, you want peer learning, you want the brand. It just
you get
happened.
The best of all worlds.
Yeah, so ISB happened. And I remember even in my interview, which Ankur Variku had taken back in the day. So he interviewed me and he said, all these degrees, why do you want another degree? And I said, I'm just taking it for the brand and the network. And I remember writing it in my application, I will not be sitting for placements. And he said, then why are you even doing this? Because an MBA is for placements in India, you realize it. And I said, yes, but I will get access to the network.
Yeah.
I will get the brand. He said, cool. And at that time, I kept half thinking that, will my mind change when I go into that environment?
Yeah.
I hope I'm able to live up to this application and not think that it was written only to secure admission. When I went there, I think the first 6 months were really difficult, because when your entire batch is just optimizing for placements in like a McKinsey, Bain, BCG, or getting into product management, and you're just like, I want to do something, I don't even know what I'll be doing.
Yeah.
I think it was very difficult. But I realized I don't need a CAD scores for a placement. So I might as well pick up subjects that I really want to learn. Yeah. And I feel a lot of times, you know, after the placement season is over in about term six, a lot of people just stop studying because, you know, they're relatively relaxed. They've gotten the return they wanted from their MBA experience.
Right.
I felt at that time I was the only person sitting in the library reading my cases, doing my pre-reads right before class, because I was finding it to be really exciting. So while I could not beat them at a CADS, I said let's work towards everything, do holistic, and let's aim for the all-round excellence award. That luckily happened to come into my lap. So I mean, I felt so many of my classmates deserved it so much more for all the amazing things that they would do. That happened, and I just came back thinking, ab khud ka kuch karna hai, kya karna hai.
Yeah.
Maybe let's start with consulting, because
yeah,
that's what everyone does after an MBA. And India has such a large market of founders, MSMEs, who want so much help with business. And the only person they have to go and discuss business with is their chartered accountant, who probably does not know as much about no code and tech and right, product management and stuff. So I thought,
let's
try and do this. And that's how it's just shaped up.
That's lovely. That's lovely. I love that. But do you think, like, just in general, like, I'll quickly double click on the point that you mentioned, right? A lot of people come to an MBA for placements, right? And there is this entire ideology and multiple articles written on how an MBA really caps out the outliers, right? Because a lot of excellent people make the choice of going down the MBA because it, you know, bridges your sort of downside risk. It equips you for these high-paying jobs, yet it reduces your ability to take risk because you put in this amount of time, effort, and money, right? Like, this is a huge financial commitment as well. What do you think about that piece? And do you also think that in a world where, you know, real insights, real exposure, and industry experience is being valued more, do you think the value an MBA certificate or experience holds is reducing marginally? And if that happens, where are we headed?
So I'll tell you, there are definitely two sides to this. And when I say this, I'm not undermining,
of course,
the contribution of either side. So one thing, I felt culturally, you know, in India, the only way you had to show credibility has been through some degree which certifies that, okay, you are an expert in this knowledge. Which is why our grandparents, our parents were really hell-bent on, you get that degree, get credibility, so that there's a safety net. Luckily, and as a matter of privilege for everyone in our generation who's also watching this podcast, you know, of us speaking in English, discussing business, they come from enough privilege to know ke kamai ke liye to tumko degree nahi chahiye,
right?
Like, your family is taken care of. You can figure your way out and earn your way through in life. I felt, but my real learning actually started after my MBA. And I would not say that my school did not teach me, the CA, CS, CMA, ISB did not teach me. They gave me the right foundation.
Mm-hmm.
They gave me the credibility.
Yeah.
Where today I can say, okay, I have these degrees and people can immediately take me seriously. But everyone just thinks of learning as whatever this institution teaches me, I will pass the exam. I think that's what learning has been reduced to. Which is why now when I look at learning every day, my mindset towards it has changed so drastically that I feel if schools had to teach one or two new subjects, one has to be learning how to learn, because you have to teach people how to become self-learners. Otherwise, they will just come into the classroom, listen to you, pass the exam, and never bother about it. Like, I remember back in school, there were so many subjects where I would write the exam.
Yeah.
And after that, I would ask people, don't ask me any question related to this paper, because now immediately after the exam, I've forgotten. And I don't want to remember it.
Yeah.
Right? If it's coming from that mindset, what are you really doing with the education system?
Correct. Tell us more about that, right? Like, this learning to learn, what does that mean, and how can we actually imbibe that?
Yeah, so I think if you think about it, atomic habits, right? Atomic habits gives you a framework, and I may be absolutely misquoting because I don't remember the exact framework, but it says that for everything that you want to build a habit in, there has to be a cue, you know, daily that reminds you of it and wanting to do it. That cue should result in some amount of effort. Now, that effort has to be hard. It can't be very easy, but not so hard that you're dissuaded away from doing it, right?
Yeah.
Which is why we've seen that a lot of times people who find mathematics hard will not take up science in school, because they found it so hard that they're like, no, I don't want to take on that challenge. I'm happy taking commerce or commerce with maths,
right,
or maybe humanities, right? Similarly with finance, so many people will find finance so difficult because the education system has not made it easy for them,
yeah,
that they will never be able to breach that threshold.
Yeah.
So the cue, then it being slightly hard, but not very hard. And then you have to have a feedback loop of a reward, which gives you an instant hit that you want to come back and do it again the following day. For me, content has been that because I know every day. So the cue is, okay, now that the clock has struck midnight,
yeah,
the next 24 hours, it has to happen. So right from the moment I wake up in the morning, while there are a bunch of things to do, any conversation I'm having, I think I'm more mindful of if there's an insight, if there's a direction, I would note it down. You know, so there's also the second concept that I wanted to say schools should teach is building a second brain or the knowledge management system. You know, teaching people how to manage their knowledge. And to give you some context to that, you know, Seinfeld was asked that how is it that for 10 years you've been running the show and it's still so funny and the audience loves it and it's at its peak because people get bored of the same kind of humor and comedy beyond a point. You can extend it for 3 years, 4 years and your jokes also get over or repetitive. And he said, it's not that our team of writers is funnier than the others, but we follow a process where every day, if it's a team of say 5 people, whatever even remotely or slightest funny incident like or an experience happens in our lives, we just note it down immediately and we put it in a box. So when we sit down to write, we will pull out 5 of those experiences and stitch an entire episode around it. So I think insight or learning comes from the fact that how many of you are actually recording what you're learning,
right,
putting it in a system where you can easily retrieve it, not depending on your memory, when you need that insight, be able to apply it in your life. Yeah. So I think content for me has become that atomic habit framework, plus the way I manage my content backend. You know, so the LinkedIn post or the written insight, I can access any of it through keyword search on my phone at any point. So even if I did a piece on say exports a year ago, it does come up in conversation. I can pull out my phone and in just about 30 seconds, I will have access to all that information. I don't need to remember it.
Right.
I put it all in a framework in the form of a book, so that others could learn from it in an organized
In manner. Something that has a larger shelf life also.
Correct. So I think these two concepts of knowledge management systems and learning how to learn. Of course, another bit in learning how to learn is curating the right sources to learn from.
Yeah.
For me, over the past 4-5 years, I've subscribed to a lot of newsletters. One thing has led to the other, unsubscribed to a lot, where now I feel the ones I'm subscribed to are great. They give me a great deal of learning daily, and I'm still on the lookout for any more source. So again, it's about recording it and putting it in your system that you keep getting insights from that source again and again on an everyday basis.
Yeah, got it. No, that's lovely. I think that just simplifies things that we need to do that, you know, a B-school will also only teach to an extent. But if I had to ask you point blank that, you know, a student or a professional, 2 years out of college, earning, let's say, 14 lakhs a year, right? They need to decide whether or not to do an MBA in this day and age, right? With their future aspiration of being a, maybe, let's say, a founder, right, of a company. What would you suggest and why?
Okay, could you give me some more context, like,
The idea is to understand that, you know, somebody who is being able to make a living, has a steady job and has an aspiration to become a founder, is the MBA for them or not in today's day and age because of how it's evolved, right? Because of how the meaning has changed, because of the fact that there can be other alternative ways of achieving the same objective by learning on the internet and finding your own way to learn.
Correct. Again, two sides. Two paths, it's for the person to decide.
Sure.
If you look at it, you know, early stage bets or early stage investors. Now again, let's talk about funded startups. If in the business idea, capital is a major constraint without which you will not be able to build, then you will have to go to investors. At the idea stage, what are they going to evaluate your business on? The size and opportunity in the market, your credibility and execution ability, because at that time you are the team and it's your skills, and out of all the available options of your competitors in the market who are building, you need to differentiate yourself. Right. So as people say, when you make your resume, show spikes which differentiate you. Mm. I think for a lot of people at the early ages, mm. when they've not achieved a lot in their life, mm-hmm. the MBA becomes a traditional safe spike for them to say that if I made it to an IIM or a Stanford or an ISB or a Harvard, yeah. that's a spike, that's a differentiator. Which tells them that they have had a certain percentile in academic score. They've passed the GDPI, they've been a part of that peer group yeah. and learnt enough where they may be better off than an average Joe.
Correct.
Okay? That's one path.
Right.
Now for the average Joe, thankfully in today's time, there is enough opportunity in the market, also in the form of media, to build one's own credibility. Mm. So either you work hard in cracking those institutions to buy that credibility with your effort and money, or you put in so much effort on a daily basis in creating so much media and so much of a personal brand that people stop asking you about your credibility. They can see that if you've written books, you've made videos, you've done some phenomenal content which is available on the internet for anyone to validate.
Yeah.
The idea here is you could be doing all of that, but if people can't validate or see it and, you know, have a certain sense of comfort, they will not take that bet
Correct.
On you, right? So yeah. these are the two paths. Now, when it comes to you don't need capital and you want to bootstrap, I feel the earlier you do,
the better.
Better it is, and you don't need an MBA.
Yeah.
So if capital is not a constraint and you start early, it works just as well as compounding, because even if you do a simple t-shirt startup in your college, I think that's absolutely fair, because it teaches you so much about how to price, you know, your competitors, yeah. design the product, how to sell, that maybe that's a 6 month gig.
Yeah.
But after that, with all the money that you would have made from that, you would think, okay, where can I invest a part of it, and what can I make from it?
Yeah.
It puts you in the right mindset to be spotting trends, to be spotting consumer needs, and working on all these aspects to gradually, over 5-7 years, having enough capital of your own where you can take bigger bets.
Correct. Got it. No, that's super rounded. I love that. I'm on the latter side of the, you know, narrative of not the MBA, because I think, I mean, I'm exhibit A when it comes to that. But then knowing both sides, best way to go about it. So thanks for that. The other bit where I want to, you know, understand your vantage point, and I'm going to stereotype here because, you know, I want to understand better. But usually we look at these, you know, engineers and business educated folks in a two different spectrums, right? And we see that although business folks who have, you know, either studied commerce, finance, business, in comparison to the folks who have studied engineering, are not doing as well in the professional world because of some reason or the other. Considering you've had the vantage point of working with them, studying alongside them, working hand in glove, what has been your observations when it comes to engineers versus business professionals?
There's just one observation, right? One differentiator. And I'll give you some background, some anecdotes from my personal life so
Please.
That you understand this. I remember when we had to pick between science and commerce, there was absolutely no confusion in my head. I had to pick commerce because I had to become a CA. Yeah. The only option in front of me was commerce with maths or without maths. And I kept trying to convince my parents that I will take commerce without maths because I hated mathematics. The entire year, all through the different classes, different standards, I would just keep reading and studying mathematics and, you know, work the hardest on that and still be scared at the end of the year from that mathematics exam. So I said, I don't want to do this. Now is my choice. I'll take commerce without maths.
Mm-hmm.
But my parents, I mean, of course, tried to reason me into that how you will need maths for the entrance exam of some college or something or the other, and pushed me in that direction. I was like, God help me, like I hate this. Okay. Now, luckily, when I did my undergrad in finance and investment analysis, mathematics was a mandatory requirement.
Hmm.
So that's how I just happened to pick BFIA for an undergrad program. That's where I realized how hard I found even finance, because it has an underlying, you know, mathematic, quant, you know, Black-Scholes model. You know, funnily enough, the room we're sitting in is called Black-Scholes room.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just hated it so much. I was like, dude, I just want to pass this exam. I don't know why in what mind have I taken finance in my undergrad. Then in CA, out of all the papers, in your intermediate and in your final, there are 7 and 8 papers each. In those stages, there's just one paper in each stage of finance. That was the worst one. Like, I hated it. And I remember in my CA final, there was strategic financial management. All my papers I thought went well, I'm going to pass. That paper, I kept coming back in 1.5-2 months leading up to the results. Every day I would pull up that question paper and see if the examiner were to be really generous. What is it that I would get? And in the best case scenario in my head, I would get a 36/100, which meant if you get less than 40 in even one paper,
you don't qualify,
you have to take the exams again. I was like, I hate this damn thing. When the result came, I got a 40 in strategic financial management and like,
let's go,
the aggregate of 50, and I was like, God help me, like I'll never do finance in my life. So in fact, when I went to ISB, I took, my specialization was in marketing and strategy, and I took no elective in finance. I was like, never taking this shit. As luck would have it, when I started off my own consulting practice, because the CA tag doesn't leave you.
Yeah.
A lot of the ISB founders who wanted to raise capital, I mean, they would say, we're looking for someone to help us. Hey, you know what? You're a CA. Can you help me with valuation? Can you help me with building a financial model? And I was like, yeah, I want to get
life
out of
is
it.
Back again.
Chodi nahi ra. So I was back into the grind again. Now, actually doing hardcore finance, because prior to the MBA, I was doing tax, accounting and all, which is not finance. You know, that's a very accounting compliance related job. Here, when I got into finance, I realized, yeah, you don't use the Black-Scholes and stuff in your everyday life. And the finance industry makes money off of people by unnecessarily complicating
terminology,
complicating concepts beyond a point, complicating showing, I don't know what calculation of net present value and making those bloody discounted cash flow calculations, which of course are important. It's important for you to understand because that's the fundamental of finance, but you don't need to complicate it beyond a point. The reason they do is because that's also intimidating the client to say, "Ye kuch to complex kar rahe hai," so they deserve the fee that they, you know, a lot of times those templates are just copy pasted. You change the numbers and you ship it out. And I'm like, this is unfair, man, because now for the first time in my life, I'm actually understanding finance through a lens of common sense, through a lens of numbers which are simply algebra on an Excel sheet. So I don't need to be afraid of, oh, mera calculation galat ho gaya. The computer's doing it. Just my logic has to be right.
Correct.
And when I started enjoying finance, I was like, that is the bloody gap I'm going to plug in the market. What I hated all my life, what I feared all my life, I'm going to ensure that
others
don't fear. Which is why, even when, you know, a bunch of these B schools started calling me saying, you know, why don't you teach M&A? Why don't you teach PE, VC, corporate finance? I was like, I'm going to teach it my way. Are you okay with it?
Yeah.
And thankfully, God has been kind. My students have been very kind that I've got the best ratings.
Yeah, they've loved it.
So far.
I know that firsthand because a lot of the students that I've interacted with and I have taken your class have testified to the fact that, you know, we loved Sarthak's class. Why wasn't this done earlier? Why wasn't this for a longer duration? Why aren't all classes like this, right? Because they were just blown away. And I'm like, this is all fact. This is all firsthand information, by the way. So
thank
kudos.
You. So, in fact, when I would teach them with case studies and everything, and I would say, listen, this is how I have figured it out.
Yeah.
Now, maybe this is not how your book will teach you, but this is the thumb rule or the logic or the common sense behind it
that helps you.
Which helps me remember.
Yeah.
And I think when you drive the common sense and you remove all the intimidating things like formulae and just apply this formula and you'll get the answer, that's when they start learning. And when they really need to use that formula, they will have no qualms in being okay with not remembering the formula, googling it, and just applying it right, as long as they've applied it with the right assumptions, they will do a phenomenal job of it.
Yeah.
So I think it's about removing everything that intimidates you. Like I said, you know, it has to be hard, but not so hard that it stops you or puts a mental block. And I feel it has taken me over a decade to overcome that.
Mm.
And my classes on finance, my teaching on finance is just an attempt to simplify it to such a degree where a lot of finance professionals actually get offended saying, how can he say it like this? There is so much more nuance to it. I know there is so much more nuance to it, but that nuance is for professional circles.
Right.
That is not for a common man. You don't need to intimidate or, you know, scare him so much that he doesn't even feel like diving deeper into it.
Correct, correct. So you're saying that the education in finance and the industry in general just complicates these simplified processes, which is why I think just the general sort of student learning these concepts gets a bit behind, we'd say. But then engineering as well, right? Like, I mean, you wouldn't give too much credit to the education in and of itself, much rather to the process, right?
And sorry, this brings us back to how I was using this
to
differentiate between commerce and math,
science,
right?
Yeah.
Commerce and science. And back, I remember during my 12th mathematics exam, I had a bunch of my close friends who had taken science. Maths exam day, they see me walking in with just like so hassled and so like, this is the worst day of my life. And then being like, this is the chill most exam for which we've not even studied like one bit.
Yeah.
And that's the earliest contrast that you see.
Yeah.
And that's because they've been studying so much finance, so much of physics, chemistry, with so much such quant heavy subjects.
Right.
That the mathematics is very easy for them. So, you know, it puts them in the right mindset to also look at finance like, I will understand it. When commerce people look at finance, they're like, God, this
they
is maths.
It. Yeah.
And, you know, it's not that they're more skilled. It's just that fear which stops you from looking at it from an open mind and being like, okay, this is surmountable.
Yeah.
And that just permeates for so long, which is why the science kids crack every job today needs data. Data analysis, it needs a concept of finance, and people from the science background are much more comfortable looking at data, speaking about it without getting intimidated.
Right.
That is the biggest differentiator.
Got it. I think that really puts it well. The fear, if we remove the fear, I think it's a level playing field, and that's super interesting. Let's get to the maybe last significant and maybe the earliest significant bit about your life, right? You became at 23, the youngest person in the country to have completed these courses, right? And these are all very grueling courses that takes up a significant and perhaps also arguably the most sort of learning years of your life, right? The 18 to 23, right? You, however, I would also consider and maybe go to the extent of calling you an outlier, right? Because you did CS, EMS and CS, but you are doing much more than, you know, most of these professionals end up doing, right? And you've built a great career for yourself. However, there's a long tail of these folks who may not, you know, and get stuck with a job or may not, you know, just qualify as well. So they spend 6-7 years in a CA and don't really do well. What I'm trying to understand is, how do you look at a CA? You did it for, of course, contextual reasons of your family background, what you grew up believing and wanting to do in the future. But do you think CA as a career path, considering the amount of effort it takes and the opportunities it eventually has, input, output, what do you think about it in the real world today?
I think very similarly, if you think of UPSC, the amount of effort putting in the input or the output, or people who study for IIT, JEE or so, I think everything will take effort, and the output you can't guarantee, not even in getting into a medical college, getting an MBBS and still getting paid less than 50,000 per month in a job. So I think the competition that the Indian population, the sheer size of the population puts you through, you have to know that the more you depend on the degree guaranteeing your job, you're really putting it at the biggest risk of, you know how they say you can't beat the market. You can't fight the market. If the market in India is the sheer size of the population, just like you, there are thousands and thousands and millions of people studying for the same degree and will get the same degree in some time. So the market equilibrium will come to a point where today, if those professionals with, say, a CA degree get about 1 lakh per month, removing the effect of inflation, in the next 5 years, it may come down to 50,000 per month in terms of buying power, right? So I would say it's not just CA. If people do CA, I today think that CA taught me how to sit in a place for 12, 15 hours undistracted and just learn up things, understand it, to be able to express it well enough in the exam so that the examiner also gives me enough marks. And I think if you put that learning in the right context, right, that is what teaches me how to research today in an undistracted fashion. That is what teaches me how to express myself, because your consumer at the end of the day is an examiner. If you're not able to, your customer is an examiner. Everything in life, you know, that people evaluating you based on how you express your insight or knowledge.
Yeah.
So I think regardless of what degree you do, it's just the fundamental foundation you need to go through. After that, you are all set to do marketing or do whatever it is.
Yeah.
Because the right foundation of learning is that. They're all teaching us different subjects.
Right.
But the hard work is the same. Mm-hmm. The way to express or learning how to express is a skill that you can learn. I think it's just about putting it in the right context. I could very well say CA today is irrelevant and I know so many CAs. I mean, to give you context, I have people at my office, you know, and I keep telling them on their faces. So it's not like they're going to watch this podcast and suddenly feel, oh, Sarthak has offended us. Right? I keep asking them, what book have you read apart from your CA curriculum? Yeah. All of them are just like staring at me blankly and thinking and saying, you know, oh, back in school, they made us read Tom Sawyer. I'm like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So that's not a problem of the CA course. So people need to start, you know, start taking away discredit from a course and start taking ownership of their life and their learning on themselves.
Yeah.
Not to say, degree ne mere ko kharab kar diya, isme mere ko paise nahi mil rahe. Wo tumhari problem hai.
But doesn't it also condition you to, I mean, it's a process which is destined to train you for a qualification at the end of it. So everybody studies till that mark, right? And then when you don't get it, it leads to a lot of this self-confidence going down, etc., right? Because we're talking about the people who do qualify, which is also a long tail of people who eventually get, I wouldn't say stuck, but they have to just do jobs, right? Eventually, which may not give them fulfillment at the end of it, because you do this 5-year process and eventually realize that, okay, life was not how they said, right? It's not like CA kar liya to life simplified hai, right? You get a desired job. The pay is not that high. Again, I'm not ditching on the entire like sort of process or the CA curriculum, right? But the idea is that the best optimal utilization of your time in 18 to 24? Or is there something better you could be doing had you not been doing that? Like, would you then be conditioned to actually work on yourself and not depend on a process where the examination passing was the criteria?
Okay, I'll give you two answers to this. I'll give you in my context and I'll give you in the context of what I think anyone else should do. In my context, I really believe in the butterfly effect.
Mm-hmm.
So even if, you know, the fact that Jivraj and I are sitting here and chatting, and tomorrow there is some amazing thing that happens in my life, I will duly give credit to this conversation leading to that happening, because I would not discredit any of my experiences.
Of course.
I think whatever I've done so far, I would give
great deal of credit. All due respect to whatever you've done, of course.
Now when I speak of someone else, okay, when I say, it also depends on what place these people come from.
Of course, very contextual.
Very contextual. So if for someone who comes from a family where the family has not made enough money to be able to afford them a house, a place to live in, you know, where with not enough passive incomes to say that, okay, even if you don't earn for 6 months, 1 year, we're absolutely okay. I think for a majority of India, even today, so many families, so many people come where they know they have to contribute to the income at home.
To the livelihood.
To the livelihood.
They have to
and
earn a
this
living.
Is a very, I think, safe path. Any degree is a safe path for you to at least protect the downside. Okay? People like us, because we come from a certain access to network, access to knowledge, information, peers, resources, if we don't go above and beyond that degree and use that, we are doing a disservice to our context and what we have been blessed with.
Right.
So I feel a lot of the CA students I see, even people who come to our office, work with us, I see them coming from such small towns and villages that I tell them, buddy, you have to do this. You have to do this because you have so much responsibility towards your family.
Right.
I will do everything possible to ensure that you pass. And after that, I have to tell you a path on what book you have to read, what skill you have to develop. Please don't confine yourself to just learning how to file tax returns. I mean, that's correct. Commoditized. So, you know, I think getting the right guidance is important. So for people like us, the degree doesn't matter.
But there are a lot of people for whom?
For a lot of people, it really does. And what I see of that population, a great cohort still needs it.
Got it. Yeah, that's fair. I think, I mean, fundamentally, you need that as a qualification to ensure you are eligible for certain kind of jobs, which will then earn a living. So I think that fits. But yeah, I think fundamentally, if you had to question, like, you know, the trade-offs, I mean, an evolved sort of like Indian may be able to make more out of their time with the same amount of like opportunity cost.
But no, tier one India, if I may say, tier one India does not need it.
Correct.
Tier one India can put their time to much better things, utilize leverage of information, access, so much opportunity in India.
Yeah.
That they can actually put themselves to. So if tier one India or people of privilege of the kind of context we are speaking with, they don't utilize it and they go into the drudgery of, oh, I'll do CA or this and that because they've got blinkers on, they're like, this is the natural next step.
Yeah.
That's a disservice.
No, that's lovely. I think that really puts things into perspective. Coming back, I think, you know, we've covered an entire scope of things. Coming back to perhaps the most significant part of, you know, your persona, which is the consulting and IB practice, right? I'd love to know that, you know, as a founder, which is working with a lot of funded as well as, you know, bootstrap founders, you have decided yourself to not raise funding, right? Of course, for the collective that you run, because of the kind of setup it is more services heavy, it is not as product-led, etc., right? Talk to us about how have you thought about funding in general before we dive deeper into, you know, aspects of your business? Why do you think, you know, as a concept, the funding bit is overhyped? And why do you personally not favor it, as we were discussing before the recording?
Yeah, see, there is so much of a survivorship bias.
Yeah.
Such a massive survivorship bias that there are, I don't know, hundreds and thousands of entrepreneurs in India. So the stat of the Startup India team is that there are 99,000 something registered startups under DPIIT today. But easily, there would be 100 times that number of people who want to start up, who are looking to start up, who haven't or have just registered their private limited entity and are hoping to take funds, and they don't know any better on whether they need that registration or not. Okay, the market is massive. The only news they're reading online is this startup raised this much capital and this and that. And I'm glad there is conversation around funding winter or whatever terms they call it to neutralize expectations. Now, fundamentally, from a funding point of view, you know, there are, and this has been discussed, so it's not an original thought, I've definitely borrowed it from someone, is there are three things that you try to balance two out of, you know. You optimize for scale, you optimize for speed, and you optimize for independence. Now, if you take external capital, you may get speed and scale, but you absolutely lose your independence. You know, you may have independence and you can also scale, but it will come with very low speed compared to the market because it's a bootstrap business, you know?
Right.
So that's the trifecta within which these things function. Now, what one wants to optimize on completely depends on their mindset and their behavior as a person.
Yeah.
If you think of me as someone who's never worked in a job under someone else,
yeah,
who's always done his own thing, first in a family business, then my own thing. I really prize my independence to such a degree that if I don't want to monetize my content, even if a brand comes to us and says we want to do something, we'll pay you crazy loads of money, more than what you earn annually, we're ready to give you, even if that context comes in and it does not somehow sync up with what I think of my content should look like, I'm just gonna say no, because for me, in that independence is important, which is why me as a person, the reason I've never been able to take equity funding is because I don't want anyone breathing on my neck telling me this is the pace at which you need to grow, this is where the industry or the market is going, why aren't you pivoting here, why aren't you doing that? I don't want to do that. I want to build slowly. I'm someone who's very happy building wealth slowly, doing things holistically. So I will not be able to do that. That doesn't mean others cannot or should not. It's very personal to them. It's similar to personal finance. I've made a lot of content on personal finance. And I always tell people, contrary to popular finfluencer belief, my top asset to invest in, even from a portfolio perspective, has been real estate. Also says so from a ticket size perspective, you know, it's a massive investment. Then I'm very happy putting money in gold. And even when I put money in stocks, it's just index funds. I have never picked stocks independently. The only individual stocks in my portfolio is because I want their quarterly reports coming into my email. So that's a system for information. Then I can read it and I don't miss out on information from this company. I just invest in index. I don't track it. I haven't seen in years how much money I made on it because I'm a very safe long-term guy. I'm not optimal. 2% extra per annum, this and that. All belief in compounding, but I don't care.
No, that's lovely. I think that independence wala framework is very interesting. And I think that's nice. But, you know, I want to double click and just understand that the average person who reads about funding, who reads about startups going public without being profitable, right? And considering you make a lot of content for, you know, a lot of us, the average mass Indian, right? What do you think they get wrong about investing and just like the world of startups, right? What do they not understand from a general funding lens?
Absolutely. And I believe a lot of very credible people have shat upon saying startups is a loss-making game and this and that. You know, I think what they're not seeing is, again, that's overgeneralization and sensationalization. Because people who are in the startup ecosystem, and I'm not talking about everyone else who's doing it as a sham, not understanding it. Everyone who understands it deeply would, of course, tell you that profitability matters. You get funding basis on what is your gross margin, what is your contribution margin, 1, 2, 3, and looking at your MIS, seeing where is that capital going? Is it going into building some fixed assets which is going to have a higher ROI in the future? Or is it going towards manpower, which is also important for you to set up the right team and being able to scale something efficiently? Okay. So when people say, oh, it's a loss-making enterprise, what they're not seeing is where is that capital being allocated and what is the unit economics of that business? Yeah. More than that, I think now on the flip side, a recommendation for startups would be, while everyone talks about unit economics, how many startups are actually talking about payback period? So I think if startups were to now start bringing in deeper conversations, not just around unit economics, which a lot of companies play with in terms of numbers, saying, okay, if we need to show CM2 profitability, how can we move something into CM3 so that CM3 negative is okay by my investor, I've shown CM2 positive. You know, people can really manipulate and do those numbers. But for you to plug that opportunity also, if you start having conversations around payback period, that will probably solve for that. So, you know, taking anything in extreme is sensationalizing.
Correct.
So I am on both sides. I think both sides have their pros and cons. I personally build a more traditional bootstrap business, but I help raise money to startups. So I get to see both perspectives.
Right. And that's the best of both worlds. Very quickly again, understanding this profitability cycle, right? A lot of startups are not profitable, right? A lot of the best ones. So we're not even talking about the ones that didn't make it. We're talking about the ones that did yet are not profitable. Do you think that's a factor of the market? Do you think it's a factor of not the best business practices at companies? Or do you think it's a factor of momentum of what is happening in the current generation of startups?
Lots of factors, okay? Firstly, overestimation of the market size, say about 4-5 years ago by a bunch of VCs. Yes, it is the time for India, okay? So I feel a lot of the great startups have actually captured at the right time, right product, have captured tier one India, have monetized on that opportunity, are now inching towards profitability, some have reached profitability. But overestimation of the market size, again through gross simplification of saying 140 crore population and extrapolating it on that is right. One major problem, which is not that MSME businesses don't do. When I discuss business with them, so many of them will say, oh, this year I've made this much profit, this capital I will reinvest, next year also I'll make the same profit, I'll do this turnover, I'll do this revenue. It's very simple for people to geometrically or exponentially start extrapolating current figures to the future, thinking this is how the world will continue to function. So for the startups, one, there has been a capping on the market size.
Okay.
Opportunity in India. Given the ticket size of monetization that they have. So if they need to get a particular scale, if the scale in numbers is not there, the product should have enough margin for you to utilize it a smaller denominator. Another bit in terms of, so your question was around, you know, why is it that the startups have failed to reach profitability?
Or prioritize it.
Correct. Another factor I think has been escalation of commitment. And again, it's a human behavior thing that happens everywhere. You know, some girl has said no to you. Now bloody Jivraj will keep going and pursuing her.
Correct.
Yeah, this is just as a joke.
Of course.
But there's so much escalation of commitment where you've committed to something. Now, even if it's a horrible relationship, some people will convince themselves, no, I can change the other person. Some people will convince themselves that, no, I've put in so much effort in this. Now if I don't do it, and let's put it in the context of doing CA. So many of people, the reason they keep going for 10 years is because they're like, if I give up on it, people will say, oh, you gave up.
Yeah.
You are someone who quit. They'll say, you've wasted 10 years of your life. So let me just attempt it once more. I can't give up. I think for a lot of startups which have reached Series C, Series D, there has been so much escalation of commitment also from their investors to have funded them so much.
150, 200 million.
Yeah. So then think about it. You know, how there is this one joke which says that if Donald Trump borrows $1 billion from a bank and can't repay, it is not Donald Trump's problem, it's the bank's problem. The bank will have to find a way to make his business work so that the bank can recover it. I think for a lot of startups where the VCs and the founders together have misinterpreted the size of the market, a lot of the money has flown, and now people are scared that either we cut the cord and we say that, okay, we're okay cutting our losses, or they're like, let's just bring in some money and see what we can do. That's where for a lot of smaller startups, you know, community stock options has come up.
CSOPs
and these unique
different
ways of bridge financing where I feel a lot of the retail investors who don't understand the risk associated with it are putting in money. It's like you're on life support.
Yeah. That's so nice. And I think it just like shows the amount of clarity you have here. Very quickly, do you also think there's a fundamental risk reward or incentive problem for the promoter when they raise external capital versus when they have to earn every bits of capital that they put into their own company? Do you think like funded companies versus bootstrap companies face that problem?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, the problem is from the point of view of people not understanding. When they say no, good capital, bad capital, intelligent capital, all of that is so important to understand. So many founders are so driven by paisa chahiye. Abhi any investor is ready to, we work with so many who later we have to stop working with also, because after every investor meeting, they will say, oh, that investor gave this feedback, now we'll go change our product to what he's saying. And I'm like, what? What you're optimizing for is raising capital.
Yeah, then that can't be the goal.
That can't be the way to go, right? Now, even for a lot of founders who've raised capital, maybe the business model is a 5x or max 10x play over a 5-year period.
Yeah.
Okay. That becomes more in the ambit of private equity than venture capital. I like to simplistically think of it as that 5% is the chance by absolute fluke that some startup blows up, goes bonkers, gives crazy return.
Okay, 5% is also a lot.
It's a lot, but I'm saying 5% by sheer fluke. And where is this 5% coming from is, think, you know, just 5% of the actively managed funds are able to beat the market, the index. Okay? So I'm taking that as a proxy to say,
fair.
5% statistical chance of you made 20 bets, one will take off. That's not your intelligence. That's just luck. Stats. Okay? That's luck. Now, think of a VC who will be investing in a minimum of 20 portfolios. If one gives a 20x return, he's just returned the principal to his investors in an 8-year period.
Right.
If two give a 20x return,
then
he's just doubled in an 8-year period, which means, you know what, 9% per annum return?
Correct.
Which is, the investors will be like, what crap? I mean, why did we have to take this risk? If he does three, that's when it starts making some amount of sense. So the intelligence is actually the bridge between 5% to 15%, right? Now, the other question is that are all of the bets who will actually take off, the 3 out of the 20, will be 20x returns or not?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a great deal of mistake is made. Because while a lot of investors may invest thinking, ye 20 mein se, I've used my intelligence, I know at least 5 will take off.
Yeah.
But if they're not 15 to 20x bets in a 5-year period, which is your exit horizon, there is no way for you to return your capital to your LPs. Mm. And from that perspective, I feel D2C as a business model, 5-7 years ago, was overestimated to be a 15-20x play, which somehow it has not turned out to be, again, because of the capping on the market on tier 1 alpha and, you know, number of people who buy. So I think a lot of business models, when founders take money from a VC, not understanding that he has an investor. If you are scared of your investor, you need to give him an exit. He needs to give his investor an exit.
Correct.
So right now, if he's happy and everything's hunky-dory, if inching closer to 5 years, you are not giving him a 20x return, he is going to prioritize his LP or investor over your happiness.
Correct.
And that's just how he makes money. And
that's his incentive. Business model.
That's their business model. I think that's where the misunderstanding has happened for so many people, where they're like, my investor has screwed my life.
Hmm.
But you don't understand the kind of return you've signed up for, which your business model cannot deliver. Had you bootstrapped this, maybe you wouldn't have gone so crazy burning so much capital to achieve scale, which the physical world cannot provide. So I think thinking that putting in capital will automatically bring the physical world to the same scale as you are imagining is again an extrapolation problem that people mistake.
Got it. No, that's amazing. I think the very well-rounded perspectives that I'm hearing about, you know, just both sides of the table are very, very great. Now, to bring this to a close, if I had to just very point blank ask you, the differences in terms of behavior or running businesses that you have observed between a funded company and a bootstrap company, what would you have to say?
Bootstrap companies, beyond a scale, like if you're speaking about family businesses, they could become complacent. That's a problem. In funded companies, because you have to send a monthly MIS to your investor, every month you're on the treadmill thinking, I have to meet my targets.
Hmm.
So I think if someone could bring the discipline of reporting, looking at financials and targets, take that as a learning from startups and apply it to a traditional business, that's the best way to go. Because people tend to think capital is my only constraint.
Mm-hmm.
That's the easiest thing for people to benchmark on, very similar to the easiest way for people to benchmark on in their lives is how much am I earning per annum. The day your only metric that you see is your annual package is this much and are you growing or not, you start absolutely not looking at or doing a disservice to every other factor. Best of this world is the agility, looking at data, getting consumer feedback, immediately acting on it. If that can be applied to a bootstrap business, I think
that's the best of both worlds. And that's where you come into the picture as well. So
I try.
No, that's lovely. But I think this has been lovely. So we've covered this entire, cycle of things that I wanted to go deeper into. As we close the conversation, I have these just final aspects of questions that I think simplify and deconstruct your persona even better. And maybe we end with a couple of final 3-4 questions that I have. One of them is in this aspect of India, right? So you have, of course, put out a lot of content when it comes to, let's say, a lot of the different sectors making money, a lot of the different business models that can need innovation. You've worked with founders. If you had to summarize business opportunities in India that will, boom in the next couple of years, what would they be? And what are themes that you are most excited about when you think about India?
So I think three broad opportunities for entrepreneurs in India. One is when you look at tier two India. Okay, look at cities like Indore, Jaipur. So much disposable income is coming in, but those people don't have an opportunity to spend money. Where do they spend money? If you can give them products that sell them status, that's a massive opportunity. So take the lifestyle of the metros to the tier two, that's where money lies. Second is if you use Indian products, like what happened of yoga and Ayurveda internationally. If you take Multani Mitti, Makhana, carpets that we spoke about, and you generate and educate and build markets internationally, that's a massive arbitrage opportunity. And the third is definitely in manufacturing, because if your Facebooks and Amazons and Googles have now taken on digital distribution and offline distribution, and you can't build a moat there, yeah. The only place you can build a moat right now is backward integration in manufacturing, because when the world stops trusting China and does not want to buy from them, the China plus one strategy, I think that's the third massive opportunity.
Got it. That's lovely. I think it summarizes all the important sort of business opportunities in the country. The other aspect is, considering that career-wise, you've gone through this entire roller coaster of, undergrad, degrees, business, then starting up by yourself, and in the middle, the MBA. What would you, if you have to summarize your learnings for a great career trajectory, what would that be for an aspiring young Indian?
I would say start reading a lot of nonfiction.
Okay.
Right from when you're in third grade. The moment you... start with Amar Chitra Katha. I remember reading so much Amar Chitra Katha back in the day. That if people could... Someone could give a modern twist to it, tell them interesting stories of businesses through Amar Chitra Katha to children. I think that's a great opportunity also. If they start reading, if they start putting their knowledge into the right place, building a knowledge management system, and if schools can aid them in doing this, giving them the assistance in doing it, I think India will change. Because I always keep feeling, what if I'd started making content 5 years before I did? Yeah. What if I'd started writing my blog, 5 years before I actually started doing it? I would have been on another level. And the only kind of regret, if at all I have in life, is I could have started this sooner. Yeah. So my advice would be third grade if you can. Start. Like.
Awesome. No, that's lovely. I think that's one of the things that I have started emphasizing so much in my life about as well. And I think somebody put it this way, that I know a lot of successful people and I don't know any one of them who doesn't read. So I think that's a good way to just put it. The other aspect that I want to really understand, Sarthak, and close on is this internal drive that you have to do things from an input lens as opposed to an output lens. And you've spoken about this in bits and parts to the tune of, you know, controlling what you can. But talk about what internally driven really means to you. How do you really enforce it again and again without thinking too hard about the end objective or end outcome which you cannot control?
Sure. So the reason it's so easy for people to look at money and how much they earn as a success metric is because that's visible. Your employer gives it to you, the market gives it to you, this is how much you can get. And no one's put any active effort in actually monitoring metrics or numbers in aspects of a holistic life, right? Like, there's this wonderful book called How Will You Measure Your Life by Clayton Christensen. The gentleman was a professor of business at the Harvard Business School for the longest time, and he unfortunately passed away 2 years ago. What a phenomenal book, which actually tells you that you can't just keep optimizing for business metrics and income metrics, right? So to do that, I think a few years ago in my life, I went through a surgical operation. While it was very minor, you know, nothing life-threatening, touch wood, but it suddenly made me realize that what have I been doing to take care of my health? If this one small part of my body just failed me randomly, I had to go through surgery, I don't even know if something else is failing. Yeah. You know, that's when I set up an Excel sheet, daily habit tracker. And I was like, okay, am I ensuring I'm having limited sugar every day? So there were columns on health, there were columns on self-development, and then on professional development. Okay. So in health, I felt it was a multiple pronged approach. One was controlling sugar intake. I thought that was a metric I could, as long as I'm not having more than one serving of something sweet during the day, that's a green cell for me. Okay. Yeah. Yellow was where two meals I've had something sweet, or I've had two cups of chai and with sugar during the day or something. That was a yellow. If I've like really gone all out, gone to a shadi, had my gulab jamuns and jalebis and everything, that's a red cell. So I started tracking that. The second was, am I doing 10,000 steps a day? If not 10,000 steps a day, am I going to the gym to do some amount of cardio or weight training or something? Most of it was 10,000 steps a day because I couldn't take out time for going to the gym and doing all of that. But I tried to do that. So that was a second part I was tracking. The third part I was tracking was trying to wake up on time, which is before 6:30. I was trying to do that for the longest time. Now, how do you put a number to it? I marked them as green cells, amber and red, and towards the end of the month I would have like this rolling average number constantly going and telling me that these many days, these many percentage days of green in food, green in health, in exercise, right? And every month I would try to beat the score of the previous month. I think if you do this, there is so much joy in filling out that cell and making it green. And, you know, getting like a full trail of green for like 6-7 days, that you don't want to break that trail. And I think if you gamify it in your life and you start measuring it, suddenly every aspect of self-improvement becomes a game, right?
Yeah.
And for professional development, I realized I'm only doing work that my clients ask me to do. What am I doing for learning new skills? So, you know, that's what actually pushed me to start reading, you know, every day, like subscribing to newsletters, reading up industry updates. So I think everyone should do that.
That's awesome. I think that's such a great framework. I remember distinctly, like leading up to this episode, I came across one of these analogies earlier as well that you'd spoken about. And I was just, you know, like for somebody who is, I consider myself to be above average when it comes to tracking, analytics, all of that, right? But in context of putting it to daily habits, I hadn't thought of it that way. And I was just amazed of how you've been able to, you know, just apply so many of your learnings to your personal life as well. And that's my other question, right? Which is to say that a lot of the things that you learn, I can only imagine the overflow of information, right? But I think information and knowledge is where it starts, not it ends, right? So many of us struggle to internalize or contextualize, or rather practice what we consume. And considering you're disseminating a lot of content, you're absorbing a lot of content, how do you actually internalize these principles or rather practice them, or rather help out your clients practice them, is something I'd be really curious to know.
Yeah, I think a lot of the insights actually come from live projects we're working on. Because, for example, I advise food businesses, so I get to see their numbers, I see what is working. So, for example, I know for all the food businesses I'm working with right now who have a chain of restaurants or units at different places, it somehow turns out that Bangalore outlets do phenomenally better than all other metros in the country.
Oh, wow.
And that says a lot about the Cosmo crowd in Bangalore, them wanting to eat out more, not wanting to cook at home, you know. Even if it's a couple with no kids away from family, I mean, so much more incentive and environment is pushing you towards eating outside. Okay. So, you know, a lot of the insights just come out from things like that. And then I'm glad that an insight from one business, which is easily applicable to another business, we can give them examples and case studies to make them understand. Because you could give them a theory framework. But when you say, you know what, this business did it or that business did it, then if they really like look up to that business, they're more willing and accepting of that advice and actually working towards putting in practice. I think for general people, what I would like to say is a lot of people, and this is very similar to in the MBA, right? They will ask you to quantify every achievement on your resume. So they say you can't just randomly say, I improved the brand of the business. You have to quantify. And people would say, I can't quantify. There is not enough data, or this is a contribution you can't quantify. I'll give you context. I think I've taken it my life's challenge. If someone says this cannot be quantified,
you'll quantify.
I will find a way to quantify to give you some perspective. A few years ago, I was thinking, okay, when I was building the framework for life, I was thinking, what are the most important things that people do in their life? How can they build a framework around it and quantify it, right? And at that time, I wasn't married. I was thinking, marriage is such a big decision that my parents are pushing me, look at profiles, my friends are making me meet people, I'd met a bunch of people. How do I put a framework around this? I started researching, diving deeply. I think some 4 or 5 months continuous, there was research on what kind of marriages work, what kind of qualities are important. Because generally, if anyone who's even watched Indian Matchmaking and Seema Taparia, you know, she's always asking people to compromise. But apart from that, there's no insight on what is it that you look for. I sat down and I wrote an entire marriage decision framework, which is a 3-part framework which people use to evaluate themselves, their readiness for a particular match, evaluate others, and evaluate whether they are in the right place in their life to make the best decision out of it. So when people say marriage is a gamble, I 100% agree, because like it is with the stock market, you can't predict everything. There's so much that can happen. But if you can take an educated decision,
That helps.
And I have that Excel or framework which I will share with people who comment and ask for it specifically.
Let's do that. But this is amazing. No, I think some really, really interesting learnings. I have last two questions. And this one, I don't know how to frame this, but I've seen this trail of enjoying the boring work in your life, right? And continuously, consistently, in a disciplined manner, do this, right? Tracking is boring. But the big dopamine hit is to see the results, right? Doing the hard work of being insight-driven is boring, but putting out content is an enjoyable process, right? Correct. However, the enjoyable things only come, like, they are the 10-20% of the job, right? The 70-80% is the grind that happens behind. And you are big on consistency, developing habits in a disciplined way, doing these things, right? Talk to us about how to enjoy the boring in order to derive the success or joy in the fancy.
Okay, so great question, okay? And it again speaks about human motivations. I feel it's very important to understand what motivates you, what you find joy in, and find creative ways to link it to that, okay? So for me, it gives me great joy to share what I've learned with people. Gives me great joy to learn. So as they say, you know, in Hindi, there's this muhavra which says, jungle mein mor nacha kisne dekha. So tumko bahut acha talent hai, you've got a lot deal of insights, who cares? Only when you can share with, it's almost like, you know, they say you need a partner, or you need companionship, or you need people around you to share your joys with, because when you don't have joys to share, you know,
what's it worth
really? So for me, if I find something insightful, I really like to share, and I feel a lot of joy in telling people about it. I'm sure people over a period of time will figure out what is it that they find joyful. And if they just find two ways to link it together, if you really enjoy gulab jamuns, you know, and you will say, if I get a constant streak and chole bhature and lassi, you know, say constant streak of 6 days of not eating junk, and on Sunday, I get like two plates of chole bhature and my gulab jamun and everything, and I'll go all out. Cheat day is a concept which is built around people who are optimizing for this to give them a result, a light at the end of the tunnel, which they look forward to. I think the reason a lot of people lose motivation is because they don't have something to look forward to. If your job doesn't give it to you, because you are feeling the drudgery, saying, what am I learning? It's just that paycheck which is coming at the end of the month. You start hating your job because there is no incentive on a frequent basis.
Correct.
So if you can build an incentive monthly, that's great. It's even better if you make it weekly. It's best if you make it daily.
Lovely, lovely. Incentivize yourself in the best manner and learn to find joy in the boring is the key to continue doing the boring really well. And that's great, I think. Thanks for sharing. The last part is, and you know, we've discussed a variety of things, but I mean, almost on a philosophical lens, without getting too deep, I'd love to understand the meaning in your life, right? Which is to say that you are doing most things voluntarily, and you could continue doing one thing, let's say your consultancy and IB practice. However, you choose to do all the other things, which is where I'm guessing it goes down to your meaning in life. If you had to summarize what that meaning is that drives you to do everything that you eventually do, and it's almost similar to the first question, but I think that'll be a great summary to understanding all your motivations and what continuously drives you to be great at what you do, which you evidently are.
I'll tell you, I think the problem in psychologically everyone's identity or motivator or what they want to do is the tags they attach to themselves.
Right.
So for example, if you go to my LinkedIn right now, you'll probably see M&A, investment banking, author, because that's a tag I've attached to myself to build credibility in front of an audience which doesn't know me. But I don't take those tags personally. In a personal conversation, I will never tell you I do that. I will say, you know what, like, I don't know what I do. I enjoy reading, so I enjoy meeting people. And the reason I do that is because I don't want to call myself a CA. For the years that I called myself a CA, I put blinkers on thinking, you know, I am trained to do tax, I'm trained to do accounts, audit, finance, and I will only do that. When I started tagging myself as a consultant, I started only looking for opportunities to help other people do this, and I did not think of content. If I start tagging myself as a content creator today, I'll stop everything else and only start focusing on it. And I feel the half-life of any profession in today's world is not more than 5 years, because trends are changing, technology is changing, the market demand is changing. And I feel it's important for one to not give themselves a tag, so that whenever there's an opportunity, you feel, you know what, AI is coming up. How can I learn AI today to build something in AI? But if I keep calling myself a commerce guy or a CA, the biggest mind block is telling myself, oh, I'm not trained in computer sciences and tech. How can I learn this? I can't. So I don't think of attaching any tags to myself. I like to be fluid. I like to read. If there's something that excites me, I will note it down, try and find time where I can dive deeply into it, bring out an insight. And if others also enjoy that insight, then that's telling me, okay, there's a market for this. So I just like to experiment every day in that feedback loop of content on what is it that people want, what is it that people like, which gives me enough information about how I can improve as a content creator, how I can improve as a business consultant, and where could possibly also be an opportunity where I'll feel so driven to say, you know what, this is great, I'm feeling driven, let's build something here.
Lovely. I think that's an amazing framework, not utilizing or taking back tags and not associating too much with them is my final takeaway. Thank you so much, Sarthak. I think this has been such a pleasure. It's been way more than what I thought it would be, because I was really excited for this conversation. And I think we've been able to really cover a variety of things that decode your life processes and just thought in general. So thank you so much for being your candid self, and it was such a pleasure.
Thanks, Divraj. Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.